right, guys. Let's start moseying back to our tables and getting serious again. Yeah. That means you, Donnie.
I'm going here.
Okay. So what we want to do is kind of finish up step one and talk a little bit more about that in step two, because, I mean, step one, step two, and step three can be boiled down to three very simple things. I have a problem. I need to seek a solution to that problem. I'm going to make a decision to start seeking solution to that problem. But it's really important, and this is something that really can't be undersold, is knowing the true nature of your problem. And the reason for that is exactly what Chris talked about. He said that, you know, we have a mind that lies to ourselves. I'm a delusional person. I'm not in denial. That's what Al-Anons have. I'm in delusion. Because I truly believe what my brain says to me about alcohol, what my brain says to me about you, my brain says to me about God. And I can honestly, in my experience, it talks about it says the most honest desire to stop, right? And later it talks about in the book, and I love this, I mean, the most beautiful description of the alcoholic. I mean, Bill spent 5 chapters essentially describing what it means to be an alcoholic. He described the physical allergy, meaning that when I put alcohol in my body, I can't control how much I take, right? He describes the mental obsession that says that I have a skewed perception when it comes to alcohol. So one of two things happens. Either I minimize the consequences of my drinking, that I'm unable to think through the pain and misery that I experienced even a week or a month ago, right? That I might think about it, but not with sufficient force to be able to come between me and the bottle, right? That it's hazy and readily supplanted by the threadbare idea that I can drink like other people, right? And then it says that I have a spiritual malady, meaning that I'm driven by fear, that I'm irritable, restless, and discontent, and that basically carry without alcohol is an asshole. It's very simple. And that in that state, there's something within me, this spiritual, emotional state within me produces such incredible psychic and emotional pain that the drink looks like a good idea. And the thing is, and a book says it very clearly, that it's not that I don't care, it's that I can't make myself care about the consequences of picking up the drink. Because what's going on with me presently, and let me just put this very simply, and sort of a cost-benefit analysis, right? Now, I told you I'm a paste eater, right? That I'm the shy girl. I'm like Ally Sheedy in The Breakfast Club, right? So I don't deal well with people. Like in kindergarten, like my report card always said did not work and play well with others. Okay. I was just one of those people that just felt like that there was something missing inside of me. And that you all like had a book or had a handbook or had a way to get, you know, to navigate life. And that I like missed that day, you know, and somehow, like my instructions on how to like, you know, navigate breathing, walking, interacting with other human beings, like just was missing something, you know. So I was always comparing my insides to your outsides. And I was looking at what was going on inside of me, which was full of fear, full of misery, depression, inadequacies. And I'm looking at you and you look fine. And I'm thinking, there's something deeply wrong with me, that there's a sense of worthlessness and a sense of unworthiness that I can't get rid of on my own. That state, right, mental, physical, and spiritual, Bill spends 4 chapters describing this, right, 5 chapters describing this. And then after he goes through all of these things and he talks about all the ways that the alcoholic will trick himself into drinking again, right? He talks about Jim, the guy who had a resentment, who came to work on a Tuesday instead of a Monday, got into an argument with his boss, right? And then convinced himself that you know, drinking alcohol in a glass, or drinking whiskey in a glass of milk sounded like a good idea, right? You have the jaywalker. The guy who minimizes the wreckage of what happens when he drinks, right? You have the other guy, his name is Fred, the not a cloud on the horizon guy who thought that self-knowledge, you know, would keep him sober. So the Bill and the first 100 alcoholics went through all of these different scenarios about the thought process that precedes picking up the first drink. And he says to us very clearly, he says that, you know, And I love this. At the very end about more about alcoholism, it says, once more, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink. This is page 43. Last paragraph. Except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power. So my brain can't fix my sick alcoholic brain. That's why we put pen to paper, by the way, but we'll get to that. You know, but the idea is that I'm a delusional person, that what I think to be true is often not, you know, that I can't differentiate the true from the false. And do you want to know why the alcoholic can't differentiate the true from the false? Well, I talked about the cost-benefit analysis, right? I said that we're in all this emotional pain, this psychic pain, right? And I know that if I take a couple of drinks, the volume on the screaming monkeys in my head are going to get turned down just a little bit, right? Now, I know that what I'm going to get from putting booze in my body will turn down the craziness in my brain. The possible consequences of that is, you know, well, I'm going to drink way too much. I'm probably going to do something stupid, wake up naked somewhere with somebody I don't really know. I'm not really sure where I'm at. Now, that's a possible consequence of taking a drink. Let me weigh that out to the mental, emotional, and psychic pain that I'm currently experiencing. Possible consequences, emotional health. Possible consequences, emotional health. That's really a no-brainer. I'm going to drink. Because I'm seeking relief. I'm seeking relief from the spiritual malady. So, after describing all of these things, Bill, at the very beginning of We Agnostics, says a couple really, really awesome, totally cool, very concise things. On page 44, it says, in the preceding chapters, you have learned something about alcoholism. That's a consideration. Now, just about every single damn sentence in this book can be turned into a consideration. You know, I read this book, and when Bill makes a statement like you have, or we have, or I have experienced, I stop and say, is that my experience too? So have I learned something about alcoholism in the first four chapters? It says, we hope we've made clear the distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. Well, if he hasn't, he's going to, in one sentence, say it so clearly, he could have just said that and we could have been done with it. He says, if when you honestly want to, you can't quit entirely. Or if when drinking, you have little control of the amount you take, you're probably an alcoholic. So I can't control and enjoy my drinking. When I'm controlling my drinking, I'm not enjoying it. When I'm not controlling my drinking, I'm having lots of fun and nobody else is. Very simple. It says, if that be the case, you're suffering from an illness that only a spiritual experience can conquer. So the idea here is that if I fit the earmarks of the alcoholic, if I read these chapters and I'm reading these considerations, we're talking about page 23 when it talks about not being able to think the drink through. How many times have you heard in a meeting, think the drink through? Dude, if you can think the drink through, find another club to go bowling, goddammit. Get the fuck out of my meetings. Seriously, if you can think the drink through, go home. Find something else to do with your time because you're killing people like me telling me to think the drink through because I cannot do that. Because I'm an alcoholic. And guess what? The misery and the horror of even a week or a month ago doesn't mean anything to me in the state of untreated alcoholism when the monkey is on my back. So honestly, if you can think to drink through, if you can put the plug in the jug, dude, find something else to do with your time. You know? Start crocheting. I don't know. But get the hell out of AA. Because an alcoholic can't do that. That is the state of powerlessness. If I could do that, I would not be here right now. I'd be hanging out in my pool, not in a dress in a church basement, man. But I'm an alcoholic. I can't. Only a power greater than myself can come between me and the bottle. The only way that I gain access to that power greater than myself is by having a spiritual experience. My book tells me that I have to have a spiritual experience. It tells me, and it says the result of the 12 steps, not a result. Like when I read the steps, like sometimes like my brain makes up stuff. You ever do that? Like your brain lies to you. It says, oh, a result of the 12 steps. No, the result of the 12 steps. The entire psychic change that's necessary to recover from alcoholism. What does entire mean? All. You know, not mostly kind of somewhat, you know, a little bit psychic change. No, an entire psychic change. The result of the 12 steps. Guys, you could have had a million and one spiritual experiences before you came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Only one spiritual experience that occurs through working the 12 steps is what we get to recover from alcoholism. I've had lots of spiritual experiences, rainbows and sunshine and all kinds of crap like that. That doesn't spell the necessary spiritual experience that I need to recover from alcoholism. Life-giving, vital spiritual experience. It goes on to say, at the very end of this page, says, if a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life was sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many of us were recovered long ago. I'm not a bad person. Like, I didn't wake up in the morning and think, you know, I want to rob old ladies, you know, I want to just disappoint my parents, I want to set things on fire. Like, that wasn't like my action item list of the day, you know? Like, I woke up and I'm like, I'm going to be good today, and I'm totally not going to drink, and I'm going to, you know, I'm not going to cut myself, and I'm not going to, like, fall through windows, and I'm totally not going to throw up all over the place. Like, that's, you know, I'm going to be good today. It's going to be a good day. And then by, like, noon, I'm, like, drunk, you know. How did that happen? Well, if a mere code of morals, a better philosophy of life, were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, I would have done that a long time ago. My parents were church-going people. My mother's a Eucharistic minister. My dad's an usher in the church. Like, I was raised by very religious people. You know, if going to church every Sunday, I mean, my parents, like, it was a requirement in our house to do charity and service. So no matter how hungover and drunk I was, my mother would drag my butt out of bed to go down to the Carmelite Mission and, like, work in the soup kitchen. You know, so, like, I was given values. I was given a spiritual way of life. I was taught charity and service, which, by the way, really served me well in Alcoholics Anonymous. But it wasn't sufficient for me to recover from my alcoholism. Because we found that such codes and philosophies did not save us no matter how much we tried. We could wish to be moral. We could wish to be philosophically comforted. In fact, we could will these things with all our might, but the need of power wasn't there. Okay, here's the thing. I didn't want to suck dick before booze. I didn't want to do that. That was not my plan or the person I wanted to be. If a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life could have prevented me from doing that, I totally would have done something else with my time and found a better, you know, hobby, I guess. You know, seriously, like, I don't mean to be like, I'm not trying to be naughty or anything like that, but let's face it. I mean, that's what alcoholism reduces us to. I'm not going to pretend that these things aren't real because they really are. We're not going to pretty it up because this is a deadly disease and we do demoralizing and humiliating things in our cups. So if I could have found a better hobby, I would have. But that wasn't the case. Since my human resources, as marshaled by the will, were not sufficient, they failed utterly. My human resources, my wishing or trying on my own power, the code of morals that my parents gave me, the religious education I was given, none of that stuff was able to help me to recover from alcoholism because I had lack of power. That was my dilemma. I had to find a power by which I can live and how to be a power greater than myself. So there's two things there. Now, Chris talked a lot about treatment professionals, and since, you know, I kind of am one, I'm like, hey, that's mean, because I actually work for a place that teaches the 12 steps, you know, and is very recovery-oriented and likes to meld both psychological and therapeutic techniques with the 12 steps. So it's sort of a twofold treatment, spiritual as well as the therapeutic and the psychological. And, you know, honestly, therapy is really useful. I mean, I wouldn't have dedicated, you know, 12 years of my life to studying it, to studying psychology. I wouldn't have invested $80,000 in grad school, like, if I didn't think it was a good thing. I mean, I'm sitting here, a recovered alcoholic, telling you that I work with people and I do this for a living. But what I will tell you is it's a human power. It's a tool in the toolbox. You know, Prozac is a human power. You know, my therapist is a human power. That chair is a human power. And when you make your higher power a chair or a coffee cup, a therapist or a pill, that's not what's sufficient to overcome alcoholism, because it's my higher power has to be a power by which I can live and has to be a power greater than myself. So I always tell this to my sponsees, because I'll get them to come out of, like, rehab. And the rehab will tell them that like a coffee cup or like a chair or whatever could be their higher power. And I say, okay, this coffee cup's your higher power, right? I'm going to take this into the bathroom. I'm going to take a big piss in it. I just peed on your God. I think you should try to find a God or a higher power that's greater than yourself. Because if your sponsor could take a dump on your higher power, you might want to try to get a new one. Now, of course, people pick something like a coffee cup, a pill, a therapist, or a book, you know, as a higher power or a human power higher power because it's tangible. And to turn your power or to think about a God, that's something that's outside of us that we can't prove, we can only experience, is a very scary thing, isn't it? So when we talk about treatment and when we talk about the things that are like Sheldon treatment, such as trigger lists, which whenever I hear that, I just kind of like, breathing's a trigger, man. Like, everything's a trigger, okay? Everything's a freaking trigger because the problem is me. I am my own trigger. So you could put me anywhere in anything and I'll still fucking drink because I'm still me. You know, so that's like the bottom line with that. So when I hear that stuff, of course, it makes my skin crawl. But what I do understand is that like anything, it's a tool in the toolbox. And so there are professionals out there who can be useful. And when we're suffering from, you know, psychiatric illnesses, like anything else, you know, if my tooth hurts, I go to a dentist. I don't pray the toothache away. I use the tools that have been given to me and I access the things to treat it. And it's the same idea. So like if you're seeing Care Bears under your bed and demons are talking to you, by all means, go to a shrink. That's what they're there for. But the idea here is that Alcoholics Anonymous is Alcoholics Anonymous and therapy is therapy. And we need to keep them separate. I do not walk into Alcoholics Anonymous and say I'm a therapist. I do not walk into therapy and say, here's a big book, thank you for your $200 and go home. And what we need to do is recognize, what I need to do is recognize that when I'm here, I'm talking about God, I'm talking about the 12 steps. And like anything else, the dentist, your therapist, your toothbrush, your car, they're tools in the toolbox. Use them appropriately. But don't worship them. Because our power has to come from a, like I said, a power by which we can live and a power greater than ourselves. You want to...
Early on, say from 1935 when Bill Wilson got sober and he got a hold of Dr. Bob, and they started this movement of sobriety and recovery. The first 4 or 5 years where they were operating in a fellowship an organization called the Oxford Group. It's funny when you look back at the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, you see some amazing coincidences. One of them is that Dr. Bob was in Akron going to Oxford Group meetings trying to get sober. In New York City, Bill Wilson is going to Oxford Group meetings and he's staying sober. And then you go, okay, well, why was one of them continuing to drink and one of them got sober? And you look at their actions. You look at Dr. Bob. Dr. Bob was coming late, leaving early, and trying not to get involved. Bill Wilson was coming early, staying late, and asking if there's anything else he can do. It was a completely different approach to it, and Bill was able to stay sober. But they learned, Bill Wilson learned in the Oxford Group the recovery process, how to treat alcoholism. He learned this in a Christian fellowship called the Oxford Group. And what he did was when he was compiling the book Alcoholics Anonymous, he kind of sanitized it. He kind of, you know, took a lot of the religious language out of it and, you know, left the spiritual in. But, you know, make no mistake about it, he learned how we must live to recover in this Oxford Group. Now, there's this book, this book that I drag around with me to workshops like this, because I think it's kind of significant just to read the table of contents in it. There was a book called What is the Oxford Group? And to a degree, this book was basically the big book of the Oxford Group. They would hand this book to new Oxford Group members, and they would read it and get an idea of what the Oxford group is. And I want to just read the table of contents here. All right, the first topic is sin. We could see that as character defects. Sharing for confession and witness is the second chapter. We can see that as basically our fifth step. The next chapter is surrender. We can basically see that as the first and basically second step. The next chapter is restitution. We can see that as our eighth and ninth step. And then there's a chapter called guidance. And, you know, when you look at the 11th step, you basically understand that that's what we try to do in the 11th step. Now, that was the instruction manual basically for the Oxford group. Bill took this and a lot of other things, and what he did was he put together a program of recovery in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. He had a lot of help. It wasn't just Bill, but he was basically the principal architect. He assembled all of these things. Now, how did he know that this stuff would work? Well, it was funny. In the Oxford group, a lot of drunks got sober in the Oxford group. Believe it or not, Bill Wilson isn't the only Oxford group member to write a book about their experience who was basically an alcoholic. He wasn't even the first person to write a book. There's a number of books that preceded the book Alcoholics Anonymous that were written by Oxford group members about getting out of, you know, this crazy world that they were living in and starting to live a right life. So when you look at step two, come to believe that there's a power greater than ourselves that could restore us to sanity, you kind of got to understand what that means. When I first saw that on the wall, in the treatment center, I'm reading the steps and I'm like, wow, I didn't see the steps up on the wall and go, that eureka, I found it. You know, I mean, I looked at the steps and I'm like, no way. You know, maybe if you're some mid-American scuttlefish with half a brain, but I got a real problem, you know? I mean, that's how I saw it. When I saw it, came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. What I didn't understand was I was bringing all my prejudices and all my preconceptions with me. You know, there's pieces in this book. I love the set-aside prayer, but there's pieces in this book that basically say, we beg of you to lay aside prejudice. We beg of you to lay aside prejudice, even against organized religion. Because if you don't, you're probably going to die. Mm-hmm. You know, you best be, laying aside some prejudice. Because here was my conception of God. My conception of God was a kindergarten kind of a conception. It came to me from Sunday school and my own bizarre mind. I pictured God up sitting on a cloud next to St. Peter, who's playing a harp, and he's got a big ledger, and he's keeping track of what the Schroeder boy's doing. You know what I mean? Oh, backed into the neighbor's car and didn't tell anybody. You know what I mean? And if I believe in this spirituality, if I believe in this conception of God, then I'm going to have to deal with him someday. And, As I grew older, it even got to be a more of a bizarre conception of God. I mean, I was getting into a lot of trouble. I was having some really bad luck. You know what I mean? And I'm thinking, if there is a God that's omnipotent and in control of everything, he's like a cosmic Alan Funt. You know what I mean? He's like, hey, let's get Chris to do a whole bunch of quaaludes and smash into the wall and ask the police, how to get out. Because these crazy things were happening to me. And if there was a God that was in charge of this whole thing, then I was his fall boy. You know what I mean? And I had all these crazy conceptions of God. So I'm going to have to develop a relationship with that. And that is going to help me? No way. So luckily, the first day I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, somebody didn't grab me and say, Chris, your problem is alcoholism. Your solution is Jesus or something. Thank God that did not happen, because what would have happened, if they would have done that, what would have happened is I would have said, thanks for the information. That's not going to work for me. I'm going to have to look somewhere else. I would have known that that wouldn't have worked. The Bible is not going to work for me. I would have known that. Now, I would have been wrong, but that doesn't matter because I would have known it wouldn't work. You guys fooled me. You dragged me in and you made it about fellowship and you actually cared about me. You know, I could sense the sincerity when you were asking me how I was doing. And for once in my life, I felt like I was at a place where I belonged. And slowly I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. It didn't just flip like a light switch. I started to come to believe. And I started to work the rest of the steps. And by working the rest of the steps, what happens is the steps are basically a connection to your higher power 101. You know, that's really what the steps are. So as I started to live a more spiritual life, as I made attempts to be a more moral person and, you know, try to cause less harm, what happened is my conception of a power greater than myself changed. Now, you know, today, my conception of a higher power is always changing. It's broad, it's roomy, it's all-inclusive, it's never exclusive or forbidding, and it's always open to new interpretation, new experience and new interpretation. I do not have the capacity to develop a specific set of attributes that God has. I cannot box God in with the exact description of what my higher power is. I just don't have the ability to do that. But some of the things that I believe today are this. I no longer believe in the God sitting up on the cloud with the logbook of my deficiencies. You know, that's kind of a conception that's kind of a noun. My conception has changed from a noun more to a verb. When you look in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks about a power. It talks about the great reality. It uses a lot of these wonderful terms for God. God is everything or he's nothing. Now, those descriptives go against the type of conception I had. And they're very, very modern, very progressive descriptives. You know, Bill Wilson was getting a lot of material from the Christian Scientists and some of the real progressive religious people. Today, I believe in the God experience a little bit like this. If you're a fish, you are in water and water is moving through you. I believe that like a fish, I am in God and God is moving through me. You know, God is either everything or he's nothing. And my experience of God is my experience right here, right now in front of you all. You know, there's no separation. There's no like God is in heaven way over there. I believe that it's experiential right here and right now. And that's the change that's happened. And we each have our own experience and we each must have our own experience. Don't let anybody tell you what kind of God you have to believe in. We are not about that business in Alcoholics Anonymous. We are not about telling you what God to believe. We're about telling you if you don't get a relationship with God, you will die. We'll tell you that. But we're not going to be about the business of explaining exactly what kind of a God for you to have. Each of us has our own experience, and that's what makes it meaningful. If it is ours, we are going to embrace it and we're going to own it. If it comes from a book that somebody said, here's the answer, and you read it, it's kind of artificial. I think we need, you know, this is an experience that we need to survive. And you know, to come to believe that a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity is important. I believe that the first step is the problem statement. What is the problem? It explains the problem very, very well. The second step is a solution statement. It explains the solution very, very well. The chapter to the agnostic, I used to think was very, very clunky. Today, I believe it is one of the best pieces of writing on spiritual experience and consciousness of the presence of God that's ever been written. It is wonderful. What it's about is telling you not to get in your own way. You know, don't let prejudice in the way. Don't understand that it's very, very important to come to a belief in this. Because if you believe that there is a power greater than yourself that can restore you to sanity, if you understand the first step that you're in real trouble and the second step that to get out of trouble, you need to develop a relationship with God. If you really understand those first two steps, you're going to be about the business of moving through the rest of the steps. You aren't going to be saying something like, well, for the last 4 years, I've been on my fourth step. Mm-hmm. That's not going to be your experience. You're going to want to get to this stuff. There's going to be a sense of urgency to move through these steps. If you understand the first two steps, you know, there will be a sense of urgency, and we are going to get going. There's another thing I want to read here, because we're kind of on the problem and the solution statement. This is a great quote. This is a great piece of writing by Bill Wilson. It's on page 174 of the 12 and 12, believe it or not. So if you don't have a 12 and 12, don't worry about it. I'll read it. It says this on page 174. Unless each AA member follows to the best of his ability our suggested 12 steps to recovery, he almost certainly signs his own death warrant. I love that. I mean, Bill is not kidding around. If we don't address these steps to the best of our ability, we are signing our own death warrant. You know, it does not say do 90 and 90 here, you know. It doesn't say keep it simple. It doesn't say easy, does it? It says if you don't address these steps to the best of your ability, you're signing your own death warrant. And then I like what he says here. He says, our drunkenness and disillusion are not penalties inflicted by people in authority. They result from our personal disobedience to spiritual principles. The next time somebody comes into your discussion meeting and raises their hand and says, I'm coming back, and, you know, here's the reason, you know, she left me, or she stayed, or, you know, or I lost my job, or I'm still in it, or, you know, whatever excuse they're going to come up with, remind them that you only drink because of your disobedience to spiritual principles. That's why you drink. You don't drink because of causal issues, like Carrie was saying. You don't drink because it's raining outside or it's sunny outside. Listen, we drink because we're alcoholic. We are placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected from alcohol by establishing a relationship with God, and our part is obedience to spiritual principles. This is basically what the second step is saying. That there is a solution, that there is protection. And if you understand the work in this book, Alcoholics Anonymous, if you understand it experientially, you will understand that it is about engaging in spiritual exercises that will prevent you from picking up the next drink. It's not a matter of choice, power, and control. It's a matter of prevention. The power greater than yourself, once you've experienced that relationship with and once you are connected back to, is not going to allow you to put alcohol back in your body. And that's really what I see step two saying.
You know, as Chris was talking, I was thinking, you know, I had the same experience with We Agnostics. You know, it's one of those chapters that really came alive for me. And part of it was when I went back to school. I was a high school dropout. I told you I was, like, expelled from, like, five high schools. I'm really not kidding about that. And then, like, I kind of decided since I really wasn't doing that all that well, I should probably just quit and stop going because apparently they didn't want me. But I was a high school dropout, and part of my amends process was to get my GED and go back to college, because when I went back and made amends, which I'll talk to later, to educators that I was verbally and physically abusive to, I started to get this education, and I studied social science, and I studied science, and I began to learn about something called the scientific method. Who's heard about that in, like, earth science in, like, seventh grade, right? Well, Bill Wilson, when he talked about the spiritual experience and the seeking, and he began to talk about it in We Agnostics, he made this statement. I was sitting in biology class or something, and we were discussing the scientific method, and I remembered this passage from the Big Book. And it says, the practical individual today is a stickler for facts and results. Actually, it was biochemistry. Now I remember. It says, nevertheless, the 20th century readily accepts theories of all kind, provided that they're firmly grounded in fact. We've had numerous theories, for example, about electricity. Everybody believes in them without a murmur of doubt. Why this ready acceptance? Simply because it's impossible to explain what we see, feel, and direct and use without a reasonable assumption as a starting point. So the reasonable assumption is that, you know, when I plug the light into the light socket, it'll turn on. What's the reasonable assumption for the 12 steps? That there's a power greater than ourselves, right, that can restore us to sanity. That's the reasonable assumption that Bill's talking about when he's talking about this. He's saying, look, we have very scientific minds. We evaluate our senses all the time. So as a newcomer, I walk into Alcoholics Anonymous, and this is what I see, right? It says, there is a solution. And it says that I have seen, when we're approached by those with whom the problem has been solved, there's nothing left for us to do to pick up this simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet, right? So when somebody walks up to me and the problem's been solved in them, right? They're recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body, and they no longer drink. They no longer think drinking is a good idea. And they're enlightened. They have this sense of peace. This energy, this light that comes within them. Everybody who has had that spiritual experience and has that connection with a higher power, we recognize it in one another, right? Like, it's almost like the God within us salutes the God within you. And there's like that thing, like we speak the same language, we could just connect eyes. When I'm talking, I'm looking around the room and I'm looking for the awake eyes. I'm looking for the people who are aware and awake to God's universe. And I'm looking at the ones who are asleep, because those are the ones I'm going to bother later. But just saying. But the idea is that, so I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and let's say in a perfect world, somebody, you know, people are actually working the steps and having spiritual experiences. And somebody approaches me and they say, you know, I've recovered from this hopeless state of mind and body. I haven't felt it necessary to pick up a drink. I live in a state of happiness and freedom. I am in the fellowship of the Spirit, right? Well, my senses, my eyes tell me that this person is smiling, their skin is clear, they're happy, they're confident, they're looking me in the eye, their body language. You know, Bill talked about Ebby, he said his roots grass new soil, right? So he recognized that there was something different about him. So the evidence of my senses say that there's something different about that person, right? Different than me. I'm in the room, right? I'm sitting in the corner. They used to call me Shaky Carrie for like the first 2 years of my sobriety. Because I hadn't worked the steps and I was going stark raving insane. And so I used to sit in the back of the room, and I would get up to like skulk to get a cup of coffee, and I would walk back and my hands were shaking because you guys were thinking at me. Even though I was in the back of the room, you're facing forward, but the back of your head, with the eyes in the back of your head, you were thinking at me. And so I would like go back to the, I would put my coffee cup down and be like, they're looking at me. They're all going to laugh at me. You know, this was what was going on in my head at all times. So they called me Shaky Carrie. Yeah, I'm really not lying about that. That was my nickname. Everybody's got an AA nickname. That was mine. Now it's the bitch, but, you know. Anyway, so Shaky Carrie sees somebody who's got this sense of confidence, this ability to communicate, this God. I evaluate my senses, right? And I say that there's something different about that person than me. I use that as a reasonable assumption and a starting point that whatever that person did to achieve that specific result, maybe I should follow their path, right? Maybe I should do what they did. Because they said, when they had that first step conversation, my first step is your 12th step. Your 12th step is my first step. If I'm in the 12th step, I'm always in the first step now, aren't I? Because it's a cycle. So they sat down with me and they explained alcoholism. I identified with them. They shared things with me about their alcoholism. We're having that conversation, that ping, ping, ping. When alcoholics recognize one another, we're speaking that same language, and we're identifying, the heads going up and down. And like, yes, this person's like me. But they're not. So the reasonable assumption is that an experience with God might help me to recover from alcoholism. It says every day, right? Everybody nowadays believes in scores of assumptions for which there's no good evidence. There's good evidence, but no perfect visual proof. Does not science demonstrate that visual proof is the weakest proof? It is being constantly revealed that as mankind studies the material world, I hate this mic, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to go like this. And it says, the mankind studies the material world, that outward appearances are not the inward reality, right? So I can't prove. I didn't watch God knit that person together who put their hand out to me and said, look, you don't have to die an alcoholic death, I have a solution for you. I can't prove, I didn't see it happen. But I can see something in their eyes, see something in their appearance. Their roots have grasped new soil. Through that conversation, we identified with one another. I know they know the pain that I'm in. And I can use that experience of seeing somebody recovered with an ED and use that as a jumping off place for me to have an experience with God. That's the reasonable assumption that Bill's talking about. He's asking us to do the God experiment. He's saying, evaluate. Look at people who have spiritual experiences. He talks about seeing people. He says thousands of worldly people, right? Having these incredible life-giving spiritual experiences. He says, take a look at these people and ask yourself, are these people manifesting something in their life that you're not? Is it possible there's something to what they're doing? So the experiment that I'm engaging when I'm working these 12 steps, when I'm at the second step, is I'm creating a hypothesis. The hypothesis says that there's something that these people are doing, that this person may have recovered from alcoholism, and maybe if I do what they did, I might too. Very simple. Then I need to test that hypothesis, right? A hypothesis is just an idea unless you test it. The test of the hypothesis is 3 through 12. Once I've worked 3 through 12, and now I have data, right? I have experience. I've worked. I've done what they've done. Now I have something to compare it to, and I can either prove or disprove the hypothesis. I can either say, no, this doesn't work, or yes, it does. So what Bill is asking us to do in We Agnostics is to use our rational minds and ask ourselves one question. How is not living on a spiritual basis working for you? And I love it because he does this. And Bill's smart. Like, he's slick, man. He was like, he had like Jedi mind tricks like you wouldn't believe. Seriously. Because like, he was great. He would tell you, oh, by the way, you know, this is what you need to do. And this is like what happens if you don't do it. You know, you're going to die, you know. And he's like, and here's the promises. So, you know, it's like, this is what you need to do. These are the consequences of not doing it. And by the way, these are the rewards of following these instructions, right? So what he says to us on page 52, and we all know the bedevilments, right? We've talked about them. But what he says, and we always miss this. I mean, the big book gnomes are always hiding things in my damn book. I always miss shit, you know? And it says, we have the bedevilments. But before that, he says, in most fields of our generation have witnessed a complete liberation of our thinking. Show any longshoreman a Sunday supplement describing the proposal to explore the moon by the means of a rocket, and he'll say, I bet they'll do it. Not so long, right? Is not our age characterized by the ease with which we discard old ideas for new, by the complete readiness to throw away a theory or gadget which did not work for one which does? Okay, how many cell phones have you guys had in the past 5 years? Like, seriously? Like, how many iPhones, right? Like, iPhone 5 now? Right? The iPhone 3 sucks because the iPhone 5 prettier. Maybe it's like a little bigger and blah, 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 right? How many computers? Like, right? Like, they've gotten smaller. Like, I have like netbooks now. Like, it fits in my damn purse. Right? So I'm always willing to upgrade with technology all the time. Right? Like, the bigger, better, more, right? Why don't I have that same open-mindedness when it comes to God and ideas about myself and the universe? I'm freaking closed-minded when that, because I'm threatened. My map, which is what we're going to look at in 4 and 5, right? My map for navigating the world is all I know. And it might be wrong. It might, it like, you know, like, remember when the iPhone, right, like the Google Maps, right, like the, like apparently like people were like dropping off in the middle of space, right, the maps were inaccurate. So let's pretend like my Google Maps, like were not updated properly, right? So I had like this old outdated GPS. And it kind of got me somewhere some of the time, mostly kind of a little bit. But I was unwilling to, you know, upgrade my, you know, my GPS. I was unwilling to plug it into the computer and get new maps. Because I was scared. Because I was scared of what those maps would look like, what it would require me to do. Because who would Carrie be if she upgraded her maps? Who would Carrie be if she looked at her life, the way that she looked at the world, the way that she looked at God, the way that she looked at you, and the way that she looked at herself? What happens if I give up those ideas and concepts? Well, I get better, but I didn't know that. What I knew was they were all I knew. How do you know what you don't know? You don't. So Bill is asking us to make an experiment, but he's saying, look, we're always willing to go for the bigger, better, more in our lives all the time. You know, like I get a new wardrobe every year. My husband doesn't like that, but I do because I got to have like the new jeans and stuff, whatever. Like I have 50 pairs of shoes. I have 50 pairs of heels. I really do. Like I'm Abel DeMarcos. Why don't I have that same willingness? Because I'm threatened with those things. I'm threatened when it comes to looking at me and the way that I see things because I'm afraid to find out that I'm wrong. I'm afraid to find out that I'm not good enough. I'm afraid to find out that there's something innately, molecularly wrong with me. But Bill says to us, he says, well, here's a good reason why you should. We're having, why don't we, we should ask ourselves, you know, why we don't apply to our human powers the same readiness to change our point of view. Oh my God, he did say that. You know, I missed that. Like, so I, you know, I'm open-minded when it comes to technology, but I'm not open-minded when it comes to my human problems, right? It says, you know, goes on to say, we're having trouble with personal relationships. We can't control emotional nature. We're prey to misery and depression. We can't make a living. We have feelings of uselessness. We're full of fear. We're unhappy and can't seem to be of real help to other people. Was not the basic solution of these bedevilments more important than we should see, than newsreels, right? Let's take out the newsreels and say, the iPhone, or the next, you know, the next Prada bag, or the next Coach bag, right? Think about that for a minute. Is not the solution to these problems more important than the bigger, better, more? And it goes on to say, when we saw people, see, I thought I was really smart until I read the big book and I realized that, like, it was all in here. I'm not a genius. Since when we saw others solve their problems by a simple reliance upon the spirit of the universe, we had to stop doubting the power of God. So we look around and say, are there people solving the problems by a simple reliance upon the spirit of the universe? Yes. Have I seen people recover from alcoholism? Yes. So I have to stop doubting the power of God. You know, I made God in my image. Not the other way around. My God was petty. My God was wrathful. My God was judgmental. My God was all the things that I, because all I knew was my perception. All I knew was my filter that I placed over everything. And I didn't have rose-colored glasses. My belief was that everything and everyone was out for themselves and that everything was a threat because I was constantly in fear. And I was driven by these 100 forms of fear. So when I looked at God, I saw God as being something that was threatening to me. Because how could God love something so worthless as myself? I couldn't access the feeling of being a child of God. The first time my sponsor explained to me one of the main tenets, concepts of a spiritual experience in this book is that we are God's children. He literally, Bill tells us in the third step. He said, he is their father, we are the children. So I am supposed to live as if I am a child of God. And when my sponsor explained that to me, and I experienced the first time I experienced the state of understanding what it means to be a child of God. Not words. Words are words are words are words are words are words are words. They mean nothing without experience. I could tell you all about Paris and I could make it seem like I was there, but unless I'm there, it's worthless. So when we're looking at this, When we're talking about the second step, what we're talking about is a need to have that experience. A need to continue with the steps, quite obviously. But this idea, and this is the one that I missed, this one statement in this book, which is probably one of the most powerful statements, says, our ideas did not work, the God idea did. I missed that. You know, you ever sit down with a sponsee and you're, you know, they're reading their fourth step to you and you're doing a fifth step and like everything's yeah, but yeah, but yeah, but yeah, but yeah, but you don't know. You don't know what those people did to me. Yeah, yeah, you know, well, you know, I was like somewhat at fault, mostly kind of, but no, you know, mostly they're at fault. And I'll have to stop them. I say, you know, did we talk about this? It says, our ideas did not work, the God idea did. Is it possible that your way of looking at things is skewed, is colored by your selfishness and your fear? And let me ask you a question. How is that working for you? Are you happy? Do you feel useful? No? Then maybe, just maybe, you might want to think about putting those ideas away for a little while and working on the God idea. Spiritual principles, they're pretty simple. Love, compassion, honesty, purity, unselfishness. I mean, we're not asking for you to, like, you know, start, go to the airport and start, like, shaking a tambourine and, like, you know, shave head. Like, we're not asking for that. We're asking for normal human stuff, you know? But those things are really scary to me because I look for what I can get out of things. When am I going to get out of being unselfish? When am I going to get out of being honest? What am I going to get out of a life of living on spiritual principles? Well, and Bill makes that really clear. He says to us, he calls alcohol a rapacious creditor. He says it'll beat us into a state of reasonableness. So what Bill does is he tells us, yes, you're going to have to give up some things. I love the statement, there is a solution. It says almost none of us like the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of shortcomings, which this process requires for successful consummation. So just to, would you guys know what consummation means, by the way? We're not, you know, I totally missed that. So in order for me to just get started with this thing, I have to have done all of these things. So like I thought like, you know, like the fifth step was like the end result. I thought like the ninth step was the end result. And what I found out, the 12th step was just the beginning. So I need to do these things just to start. It says, but we saw, that we saw it worked in others, right? And we had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we've been living it. Do I believe that? Do I believe that my way of doing things is not working? Is life run on self-will? How's that working out for me? It goes on to say, we're approached by people with the problem has been solved. Nothing's left for us to do is but to pick up the spiritual kit of tools laid at our feet. I have a personal responsibility. No, I cannot combat my alcoholism. No, I cannot think the drink through. No, I can't do that. But I do have two options. I can die an alcoholic death or live on a spiritual basis. So each day I make a conscious choice to live on a spiritual basis. My sponsor gave me a kit of tools. We talked about that earlier. This, all 36 principles of Alcoholics Anonymous are the kit of tools that have been laid at my feet. My job is to pick it up. If I do that and use these tools to the best of my ability, there's a good chance I may not drink today. If I do that tomorrow, there's a good chance I won't drink tomorrow. There are no guarantees in life, except for death and taxes. But my experience tells me that if I do the best that I can on a daily basis, I will get a daily reprieve. It goes on to say that we found much of heaven. We've been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence, which we have not even dreamed. So here we go. Shit you don't want to do. Directions, pick up the spiritual kit of tools. Well, this is what happens. We've been rocketed into a fourth dimension. We didn't mosey. We didn't take our darn time. We're rocketed. There's time frames in the big book. It's called Next Now Launched. You know, I love pointing that out to people. You know, Next Now Launched. Never does it say, wait a little bit. Take your time. Step a year when you feel like it. Eat some chocolate, take a bubble bath, rub your inner child, mentally masturbate for a little bit, and then do some steps. Nowhere does it say that in the big book. Next now launched. Those are the time frames. So my job is to pick up that spiritual kit of tools. So what I do is I reflect on my experience. What has been my experience? Alcoholic degradation, the inability to control how much I drink once I start, the inability to stay away from alcohol, no matter how great the necessity or wish, and a spiritual malady that kicks my butt on a daily basis. That's my experience. So, die an alcoholic death or live on a spiritual basis. What are my options? I've done the dying alcoholic death, and it ain't pretty. Live on a spiritual basis. Those are my options. But like I said, it's like there's those little things. The God idea, my ideas didn't work. The God idea did. So that's a consideration I need to take into steps 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12. Is to consider that what I think is not reality. And that I need to stop worshiping my thoughts. We talked about needing to we need to gain access to a power greater than myself. My mind is not a power greater than myself. My mind rides me like a, I'm trying to behave myself with the language, I'm telling you. My mind rides me, right, like an ass. It does. My thoughts ride me like an ass. They control everything that I do. Because I worship my mind. I worship my thinking. If I think it, it must be real, so it's true. So I'm going to act as if whatever I think is real and true and behave in that way and react that way to you, then you react that way to me because I'm reacting to what I think you're doing in my head and what I thought about what you thought about what I thought I was doing. And then I want to know why people don't like me, why I have no friends, and why I like to drink a lot. It's making sense. So I have to really consider. And this is important. Do my ideas work? Am I willing to put aside what I think I know to have an experience with God in the steps? So when I walk into the fourth step and I start saying, well, I don't really resent that. I don't really want to look at that. Or I'm going to pick and choose the amends I make. Or I'm going to pick and choose what I actually tell on my fifth step. Can I consider my ideas do not work and the God idea does? You want
to? Would you rather hold on to your old ideas or would you rather survive?
Yeah.
You know, that's basically what this step is saying. It's funny. It says, you know, they ask you to let go of your old ideas. They don't ask you to let go of your bad old ideas. They ask you to let go of all your old ideas. That's revolutionary. That's revolutionary. But don't make any changes in the first year.
Except for stopping drinking.
Yeah. Except for stopping drinking. How much time we have left here, Bill?
10 minutes.
20 minutes. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
We got a few minutes. You know what I want to do is I want to just start on step 3 a little bit. Once we've identified the problem, once we've identified the solution, there's some really, really good information right after the how it works part. You know, the how it works that everybody reads? A, that we're alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. C, that God could and would if he ever saw it. Once we're convinced on these ideas, it's saying that we're now at step 3. Just what do we mean by that and just what do we do? The first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. You know, this sounds easy, but we've been living our life on self-will. There's nobody more selfish than an alcoholic. There's nobody more self-centered than an alcoholic. There's nobody more self-absorbed than an alcoholic, though we usually don't think so. I mean, I was like this. I'm sitting in treatment. It's like March of 1989. I've never seen a big book before, but they give you a big book at this treatment center. That was the 12-step part of the treatment center, handing you a big book. Everything else was group. You know, anybody ever been in group? Where you're sitting around a big circle and talk about your day? Yeah, that's helpful. Anyway, not that I judge. Anyway, Anyway, I'm reading this section in here. I'm reading this part right here. I can remember it like it was yesterday. You know, our actor is self-centered, egocentric, as people like to call it nowadays. You know, I'm the actor that wants to run the whole show. Selfishness and self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. And I'm reading this and I'm going, yeah, that's my roommate. You know what I mean? I mean, I was absolutely sure it was my selfish roommate, you know, the guy who keeps me awake at night praying, you know? Jerk. Anyway, I mean, I am beyond self-centered, and this is how crazy I was. I was in rehab. Now, we are beautiful. We beg to get into treatment. Oh, please let me in. Oh, I'm dying. You know, they get a little, you know, so okay, come on in. They give you a little bit of Librium. About a day later, you're looking around going, man, this place ain't run right, you know? I can't believe, you know, how unfair. What do you mean I can't use the phone? What? You know, I got to call my girlfriend. I mean, and, you know, this place just, and this is what I'm thinking. I'm in treatment for like 3 days and I start to organize the rest of the boobies. I'm like, we got to get together, you know, and if we get together, you know, we could demand, you know, phone rights and better food. I got a hospital plastic on my wrist. I'm a booby in the hatch. And I'm telling everybody, come follow me, you know, I mean, just think about how self-centered that is. That's nuts. That's nuts. But you could not have told me I was nuts. I thought I was, you know, I was active. I was, you know, trying to work toward, you know, a better situation for all of us, the, you know, paying customers or something. You know, it's just crazy. So sometimes we are so self-centered, we don't understand how self-centered we are. Remember what I said about Chuck C? He basically said that the main problem is a separation from God. I believe that we have a vacancy within us, and it's a God-shaped vacancy. And we try to fill it with everything we can possibly fill it with. We try to fill it with sex. We try to fill it with booze. We try to fill it with drugs. If we can only just do just enough cocaine and just enough heroin and just enough scotch, you know, I'll get right there, you know. I'll feel that divine feeling, you know. And we're searching for this divinity. And we're searching in the wrong store. You know what I mean? We're searching in the wrong place. We're trying to use outside stuff to fill a vacancy within us that is a spiritual vacancy. You have to fill it with an experience of God. And in step two, we start to understand that. In step three, we make a decision to head in that direction. We make a decision to embrace this God idea, like Carrie was talking about. We make a decision to go through the rest of the steps and to seek an understanding of, to the best of our ability, and an experience with the divine. Because that's what we've been looking for all our lives anyway, because we have this sense of being alone. We think that we're the only ones here. You know what I mean? It's like, and nobody else matters. Like, it's all me. You know, it's crazy. We are not the only ones here. We're a piece of humanity, you know? And we think we're the center of the universe. Listen, we're not the center of the universe. We're not even close to the center of the universe. Our solar system isn't even close to the center of our galaxy, and our galaxy isn't even close to the center of the universe. Our galaxy isn't even the center of the universe, let alone us. You know what I mean? Yet we think everything revolves around us. And, you know, and all of you are alkanauts who just orbit around planet Chris. You know, I mean, it's nuts how self-centered we are. That has to be abandoned. We need to shoot for a new experience. We need to shoot for a new experience. And in step three, we become willing to seek this experience with God. We make a decision to do it. And a decision always has to be followed by action. You make the decision and then you follow up that decision with action. You know where it says it, the third step prayer, you know, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me. We've all said it 100 times. That prayer is an affirmation prayer. And what an affirmation is, you're affirming something that you already believe. So you don't just say, doing the third step is not saying that prayer. Doing the third step is becoming willing to seek an experience with the divine. And one of the ways to do it is the rest of these steps. And that's the decision that we make. What we would like for everybody to do tonight is, if you've got unfinished amends, if you have unwritten inventory, if you know that you should really be helping other alcoholics, but you just don't kind of find time for it, you got unfinished business in Alcoholics Anonymous. Understanding some of the stuff we covered here tonight, in your evening meditation, in your evening review, we would ask you to do one thing. To come to terms with what the third step is asking you to do, and then in your own way, say the third step prayer. Now, if you're already about the business of everything that I said, if you've done your amends and you're working with other people and you have a prayer and a meditation discipline, you don't have to say the third step prayer. You know, you don't have to say it every day. You have to say it like one time and really mean it and then move forward. But if you have unfinished business, like most of us do, that doesn't mean it's bad or it's good, it's right or it's wrong. If you have unfinished business in Alcoholics Anonymous, look at that tonight and then approach this third step decision and the affirmation prayer. And we're going to start talking tomorrow. We'll finish up. Carrie will talk a little bit more about the third step. But we're going to start talking about the solution tomorrow morning.
Yes, about time.
Okay? All right, we're done for the night.